The FBI is able to do that work credibly because it is not, and is not seen as, a tool of the president. Without that reputation and reality at both Justice and the FBI, a president is left with no way to resolve investigations of his administration, short of appointment of some kind of special prosecutor. This discourse obviously did not appease him. A short time later, with a serious look on his face, he said, "I need loyalty. I expect loyalty." During the silence that followed, I didn't move, speak, or change my facial expression in any way. The President of the United States just demanded the FBI director's loyalty. This was surreal. To those inclined to defend Trump, they might consider how it would have looked if President Obama had called the FBI director to a one-on-one dinner during an investigation of senior officials in his administration, then discussed his job security, and then said he expected loyalty. There would undoubtedly be people appearing on Fox News calling for Obama's impeachment in an instant. This, of course, was not something I could ever conceive of Obama doing, or George W. Bush, for that matter. To my mind, the demand was like Sammy the Bull's Cosa Nostra induction ceremony, with Trump in the role of the family boss, asking me if I have what it takes to be a made man. I did not, and would never. I was determined not to give the president any hint of assent to this demand, so I gave silence instead. We looked at each other for what seemed an eternity, but was maybe 2 seconds or so. I stared again at the soft white pouches under his expressionless blue eyes. I remember thinking in that moment that the president doesn't understand the FBI's role in American life or care about what the people there spent 40 years building. Not at all. In an earlier time in my career, and at a younger age, I wouldn't have had the nerve to keep my composure, to not break the icy stare with a nod or some muffled word signaling agreement. Even at the age of 56, with a fair number of scars, and in my 4th year as director of the FBI, I still had to talk to myself, as I sat inches from the president, staring him directly in the face. The voice inside said, "Don't do anything. Don't you dare move." Trump broke the awkward standoff, looking down at his plate and moving to another topic. My cold response didn't seem to faze him much, if at all. Dinner continued, pleasantly enough. As we continued our encounter, I don't use the word conversation, because the term doesn't apply when one person speaks nearly the entire time. I tried to help President Trump understand the value that the separation between the FBI and the White House offers the president, but it was very hard to get a word in. For the rest of the meal, pausing only now and then to eat, he spoke in torrents, gushing words about the size of his inauguration crowd, how much free media coverage he'd been able to generate during the election, the viciousness of the campaign. He offered his view of the Clinton email investigation, referring to it in 3 phases, each of which, in his telling, bore my name. In Comey 1, he said, I saved her with my July 5th announcement that there was no prosecutable case against her, although he added that I was wrong about that conclusion. In what he called Comey 2, I did what I had to do by informing Congress that we had restarted the investigation. In Comey 3, which was my final letter to Congress, closing the case for a second time, he said I saved Hillary again, but that she totally misplayed that. He sounded like he was reciting the plot line to his favorite TV show. He talked about the trappings of the White House, saying something to the effect of, "This is luxury, and I know luxury." I remember glancing again at the one poor statue I could see over his shoulder with the mantelpiece on its head and thinking that made sense. He went into another explanation, I'd seen many of them on television, about how he hadn't made fun of a disabled reporter. He said he hadn't mistreated a long list of women, reviewing each case in detail, as he had in our earlier conversation. There was no way he groped that lady sitting next to him on the airplane, he insisted, and the idea that he grabbed a porn star and offered her money to come to his room was preposterous. His method of speaking was like an oral jigsaw puzzle contest with a shot clock. He would, in rapid-fire sequence, pick up a piece, put it down, pick up an unrelated piece, put it down, return to the original piece, on and on. But it was always him picking up the pieces and putting them down. None of this behavior, incidentally, was the way a leader could or should build rapport with a subordinate. All of us struggle to realize something Patrice spent years telling me as I took on one position or another. It's not about you, dear. She often needed to remind me that whatever people were feeling, happy, sad, frightened, or confused, it was unlikely it had anything to do with me. They had received a gift or lost a friend or gotten a medical test result or couldn't understand why their love wasn't calling them back. It was all about their lives, their troubles, their hopes and dreams, not mine. The nature of human existence makes it hard for us, or at least for me, to come to that understanding naturally. After all, I can only experience the world through me. That tempts all of us to believe everything we think, everything we hear, everything we see is all about us. I think we all do this. But a leader constantly has to train him or herself to think otherwise. This is an important insight for a leader in two respects. First, it allows you to relax a bit, secure in the knowledge that you aren't that important. Second, knowing people aren't always focused on you should drive you to try to imagine what they are focused on. I see this as the heart of emotional intelligence, the ability to imagine the feelings and perspective of another me. Some seem to be born with a larger initial deposit of emotional intelligence, but all of us can develop it with practice. Well, most of us. I got the sense that no one ever taught this to Donald Trump. The president asked me very few questions that might prompt a discussion. Instead, he made constant assertions, leaving me wondering whether, by my silence, I had just agreed with everyone that he had the biggest inauguration crowd in history, had given a great inauguration speech, had never mistreated women, and so on. The barrage of words was almost designed to prevent a genuine two-way dialogue from ever happening. Then there were the baffling, unnecessary lies. At one point, for example, the president told me that Chief of Staff Reince Priebus didn't know we were meeting, which seemed incredible. A chief of staff should know when the president is dining alone with the FBI director. Then, later on in that same dinner, Trump said casually, "Reince knows we're meeting." Unprompted, and in another zag in the conversation, he brought up what he called the golden showers thing, repeating much of what he had said to me previously, adding that it bothered him if there was even a 1% chance his wife Melania thought it was true. That distracted me slightly, because I immediately began wondering why his wife would think there was any chance, even a small one, that he had been with prostitutes urinating on each other in Moscow. For all my flaws, there is a 0% chance, literally absolute zero, that Patrice would credit an allegation that I was with hookers peeing on each other in Moscow. She would laugh at the very suggestion.